Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen MacRamos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Since Mary has decided to abandon the podcast this weekend, graciously willing to guest host is the hilarious and talented Mina Dunn. Mina, thanks so much for picking up Mary's slack.
No problem.
So, MLB's number one ranked prospect, 20-year-old Ronald Acuña, made his debut on Wednesday versus the Reds, going 1-for-5 at the plate. In his first four games, he's gone 6-4-17, with his first home run coming on Thursday against Homer Bailey. Braves GM Alex Anthopoulos said on April 19th, "We're looking for Ronald to get hot at this point. We prefer to call up players when they're performing at a high level, when they're locked in." Since that statement, Acuña hit 300 in AAA. What should we expect from him this season?
I'm hoping for really good things from him because I took him in the Hardball Times franchise player draft, and I don't want to look like an idiot. So I'm going to say that he is going to be amazing this year.
Look, I'm all for that. I think that he's such an exciting player, and he's, first of all, adorable, which is, you know, all I really care about. So, I mean, if he can produce at the levels that he's been producing in the minors, then, I mean, that would be incredible.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely going to be an adjustment period where, you know, when he comes up, he's going to be able to hit a lot of things, but then league's going to adjust to him, so he's just going to adjust to just to the league. But I think he's a player who is very capable of making those adjustments. So I think he's gonna have a successful season. But I also think, like, no one should be too hard on him when those adjustments happen.
Yeah, I think that growing pains are perfectly reasonable to expect, but I don't think, I mean, in this very small and short sample, I mean, he's seemed to prove that his stuff can play at the majors if he's able to continue to adjust with the league.
Yeah, and just looking at his projections, Zips and Steamer both put him at right around average with the bat this year, which, you know, that seems reasonable to expect for a 20-year-old, even one as talented as him. But at the same time, he also has the talent to outperform those expectations. So just like you guys said, a matter of if he can make the adjustments.
Agreed.
And so Acuña's debut wasn't the only noteworthy one this week. On Monday night, Jenny Kavner became the first woman since 1996 to call play-by-play for a major league team's television broadcast, subbing into the Rockies broadcast. Kavner is just the third woman in MLB history to land this opportunity. The first was Mary Shane, who started on radio in 1976 before moving to television. Susan Waldman, who currently does color commentary for Yankees radio broadcasts, got her shot at TV play-by-play in 95 and then again in 96. Following her play-by-play stint, Kavner went back to her regular job as host of the pregame and postgame show on AT&T Sportsnet Colorado, but she may get the chance to fill in again in the booth. Mina, you wrote about Kavner's historic broadcast for SB Nation. What insight did you gain from doing that?
Well, first and foremost, that commenters still hate women, apparently. It was only, you know, a couple paragraphs, so, I mean, there was no, like, in my research or whatever, there was no real aha moment, but on the post there was over, you know, 300 comments of, you know, I mean, maybe they were perfectly pleasant, but I'd bet that more than a few of them were critical of any pro women views. You know, people like to say to, you know, ignore or you know, just completely, like, push aside any, you know, quote unquote trolls like that. But I mean, I would posit that these people, I mean, even if it is, you know, just a big joke to them, this is still somebody's, you know, uncle, somebody's brother, someone's, you know, maybe even aunt, you know, that it has some kind of sway in the world and how we talk about and how we view women. So I think that especially when it's something, you know, on the public scale, I mean, and on a personal level, I get if, you know, if there's someone in your mentions, you know, or on Twitter or in your personal life that you just want to ignore, I get that. I subscribe to that thought. But I think when it's someone in the public sphere, I think it's fair and even important to challenge and evaluate how we talk about women. And in this case, women in the context of sports. And I think, you know, the Rockies, at Rockies on Twitter, I think they did a really good job of challenging that, you know, even in their own mentions. And I mean, it isn't always the outright blatant disrespect of women. I think that it's also, you know, I talked about in that article about how a couple of outlets, including one of the, I think the Rockies sideline announcer possibly, had mentioned like that she was knowledgeable or something like that as like their main criteria of praise, which I think is just super belittling to think that someone who has worked in Major League Baseball for 12 years would need somebody to vouch for that. So just things like that, just kind of evaluating how we talk about women in the context of sports.
Yeah, totally. I think that, you know, that's super important, especially with all things considering in sports, especially since we don't see that representation as much as we would like. And speaking of that representation, how do we get more women into MLB broadcast booths? Is Kavanaugh's path the only way, or are there other avenues for women and non-cis men to follow?
Yeah, this is a really good question because, you know, we talk about how to get women into front offices and how to get, you know, women and non-men into, you know, roles that we see traditionally occupied by men in baseball a lot. But an area where I think it maybe doesn't come up as much is in broadcasting. You know, I think we have this kind of set idea of, oh yeah, we have men in the broadcast booth. You have, you know, former players usually doing color commentary. You have women certainly involved in broadcast, but usually they have the role of like sideline reporter, which is obviously a very important job to have, but, you know, to limit what women can do to just that, that's obviously less than ideal. And, you know, it's hard to get into broadcasting. It's so many people's dreams and so few people like actually get to do it at the major league level. So it's a hard path to follow no matter who you are, but it's obviously even more difficult if you are a member of a group that has historically been underrepresented, which, you know, in this case includes both women and people of color because, you know, it's obviously a largely white male thing as much of baseball is. Side note, if you guys don't watch the show Brockmire, they do a really good job dealing with it in the season premiere this past week. It's a lot of fun. That's a side note though. sorry, I just like to talk about TV. But yeah, you know, obviously you got to start at the bottom if you're going to be a broadcaster, as with, you know, most industries. And it's a matter of opportunities existing early on, you know, whether that's in college or getting more women into minor league baseball broadcast booths or indie league broadcast booths even. It's, yeah, no matter what, it's going to be a long, hard journey for any woman or non-cis man who is attempting to get up to the major league level, but it's a matter of the opportunities existing at all because often they just don't.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that I don't think I have any real answers for how we get more women and non-cis men into booths, but because I think if we had an answer, we would hopefully have already done it. But I agree with you, Sarah. I think that, you know, on top of that, I kind of undersold myself and how excited I would be to hear a woman on, like, on the broadcast. I know when I sat down for, like, the first Sunday night baseball game of the year this year, I was still kind of reeling from hearing a woman's voice on the broadcast because, you know, as you grow up, it's just something you sort of, or I sort of just took for granted that it's, you know, it's going to be a man talking about the game. It's going to be them sort of being this, like, shaping of how we see the game. And so to have a woman be in that role and to hear her be so insightful, I mean, you know, there's nobody, no announcer is perfect. Nobody's going to love everybody, but she does a great job. And just hearing that and having that is just, I think, something that's so, like, I don't want anybody to ever take that for granted because it's such a special thing, I guess. And it's unfortunate that it's a special thing. And so I guess that's where this question is even coming from. How do we make it so that when people are growing up, they don't take it for granted that there's going to be a man in the broadcast booth.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, there are a few minor league teams that have a woman or non-cis man broadcasting, and in the minor leagues, usually you don't really have both play-by-play and color until it's like the higher levels, but at the same time, like, while there's a few who are out there, it's not as though broadcasting jobs are easier because sometimes you get stuck at that level for so many years, and then, you know, where does it go from there? And I'm wondering if there is a way that more women and non-cis men can come up through broadcasting the minor leagues or just having more shots at broadcasting. Maybe it might be if someone won't be able to fill in the booth one day, and they know well in advance, why not ask someone from the team's, you know, minor league affiliates if, you know, so-and-so is available, not just because they're free to do it, but also because, you know, they're knowledgeable about the team and the franchise and, you know, even better if they're a woman. So I think that's one way to go about it.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I know that, I mean, it happens so often, like, where, you know, there's that role to fill, and why not make it solve two problems at once, I guess.
Our next topic on Wednesday, Tampa Bay recalled 33-year-old pitcher Johnny Venters, making it the first time Venters has appeared on a major league roster since the 2012 NL Wild Card game. Venters has appeared on a major league... He spent the past six seasons undergoing three surgeries, including Tommy John surgery. Though Venters' story is remarkable, it is not without precedent in Major League Baseball. There are 42 players with at least 10 years in between Major League appearances. The longest time span belongs to pitcher Paul Schreiber at 22 years.
Yeah, this is kind of nuts. This guy first appeared in 10 games in 1923 for the Brooklyn Robins before he injured his arm. And then he returned to baseball in 1930 and played for various semi-pro leagues until they folded. Then in 1937, he attempted a comeback with another semi-pro team, but that didn't last more than the season. And then in 1945, while he was a pitching coach, he appeared in two games for a depleted Yankees team. So that explains why it took him 22 years the appearance to another. Obviously, he was still playing baseball in between, but not at this level.
Yeah, and I mean, another notable player is Satchel Paige, who made his debut in 1948 at the age of 42, the oldest player to make their major league debut. He appeared in a game in 1965 for Kansas City after signing a one-day contract with the team. Then he eventually signed with Atlanta in 1968 as a player coach in order to gain service time to qualify him for MLB's pension plan, but he did not appear in any regular season games for the team. I actually do have another another player who had a long layoff, I guess, in between. There's Charlie O'Leary, who played a game when he was 58 years old. He played for the Detroit Tigers from 1904 to 1914, but he has one plate appearance in his career in 1934 with the St. Louis Browns. But he didn't come back just for like one plate appearance. He was actually a coach and only stepped in a pinch. And I actually, I was looking this up because I was, interested after, Rafael Palmeiro, tweeted about wanting to make a comeback. And so I was wondering, you know, who are the oldest, players, and Charlie's got him beat.
That's super interesting. And yeah, in recent years, there's a 4-player tie for the longest, time span between major league appearances at 9 years. There's Corey Aldridge from 2001 to 2010, Robinson Cancel from 1999 to 2008, Aaron Hulbert from 1996 and 2005, and then Carlos Pulido from 1994 to 2003. Are there any other players with noteworthy breaks in their playing career?
Well, these obviously weren't quite as long as some of the ones that we've mentioned, but I think you have to kind of talk about all the players who ended up serving in World War II and missed significant playing time due to that. And there were big names that this happened to. You know, Ted Williams took 3 years off to serve in the military. Bob Feller, Joe DiMaggio, you know, these weren't, it wasn't like it was just, you know, random people no one had ever heard of. These were like big names who, you know, took 3 years off, in some cases in their prime, to, you know, go off and serve in the military. And that's something that is kind of hard to imagine, I think, in this day and age. It's also kind of absurd that, you know, Ted Williams, like, particularly, like, goes off to war, comes back, and does not miss a beat at all. Like, it's just kind of funny to look at his BREF page and to see, like, all this black ink up to 1942, then 3 years off, and then comes back, all this black ink. And it's like, imagine just being that good that you can go off and serve in a war for 3 years, yeah, and then come back and still be, like, one of the best hitters in baseball.
Yeah, that's a good point there, you know, especially since there are so many of them, and like you said, so many big names. So that's a good one. I can't come up with anything off the top of my head. And the only ones I've thought of are like players who go to foreign leagues and then come back, but they're still playing, and it's not usually as long. And most of the time, if a player from MLB goes to a foreign league, you know, it's very rare that they come back, and usually it's just like a year or two stint. So that's the only thing that I can think of. And now for our Twitter questions. This one is from Saucy Jack at Jean-Paul _Fartre. Which three nationals would you choose to be your best friends?
I guess this one I should probably go first, but I haven't put much thought into it, just because it's like, you know, all of them are already my precious, precious sons. So, I mean, they're already kind of there in my heart. But I think I would have to go with Max Scherzer, because first of all, like, if you ever needed like a pep talk, like, you would get probably the greatest pep talk of all time. Just like by texting him and being like, hey, buddy, I need ya. And then Sean Doolittle, obviously. And I think I have to also go with, it's a toss up between Pedro Severino and Trey Turner. Cause Pedro is, I don't know if you guys have watched him play. He's only been up in the bigs for, a couple of shorter stints, and now I think he's pretty much up for good, but he's like a little energizer bunny behind the plate. And it's incredible to watch, and all the pitchers like really love him, and it's pretty adorable. But I think that Trey would just be like that friend that you could go like and do like boring things with, but still like have fun. So, I pick 4 and those are my final answers.
I do think this question was obviously designed for you because you specifically asked for questions for Mina, but I also want to kind of weigh in on this, because I want to just mention that being friends with Max Scherzer means that you get access to so many dogs. You know,
yes.
He and his wife, true. Erica, are super involved in dog rescue, which I'm sure we've talked about on here because this is very important to me. So you would get to play with so many dogs, and he has multiple dogs with heterochromia like he has, and yeah. I just think that's adorable. And also being friends with Sean Doolittle means that you get to hang out with Aaron, too. So
right,
basically
exactly.
I'm in this for their wives. I'm not in this for them. So much.
Honestly reasonable.
Yes.
So I would also say Max Scherzer and Sean Doolittle, like those were the first two off the top of my head. And then I have kind of an odder one, which would be Gio Gonzalez.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Mainly because when he was with the A's, one of my best friends, I think, tweeted something at him and was like one of those things like well back before, like how many retweets until like I can get this, and she did this back in like 2010, 2011, and it was like, hey Gio, if this happens, will you go to Disneyland with me? And it did, but they still haven't gone to Disneyland in like 8 years, so
you
I would be friends with Gio Gonzalez just so that my friend can go to Disneyland with him.
Incredible. Yeah, Gio's so like, I love Gio. I think he's so like precious and bubbly. But like, he's one of those players where like in every post game interview, like he'll go on for like 20 minutes about like other players and like all of their accomplishments. And it's really funny because it's not forced, but you can tell it's done with intention. And he's a very personal guy. It seems so. I totally get that pick. I support it 100%, and not just for the Disneyland part.
But also imagine if you went to Disneyland with Max Scherzer and all the dogs.
True. Are dogs allowed in Disneyland?
I think it may be a thing where you can have, like, service dogs, and they're cool with emotional support animals, too, which I don't think Max's dogs are. Yeah. They may be. I don't actually know. I shouldn't make assumptions. But you know what? I think that they should make an exception in the case of Max's dogs because they're amazing.
There should just be a dog day at Disneyland.
That sounds like so many lawsuits waiting to happen, but I am also totally on board with it.
I'm just really here for the dogs.
That's the motto of my life.
So the next question is from John at John Emelianoff. Excessively long games and prevalence of three true outcomes instead of balls and plays and base runners make MLB increasingly tough to enjoy for casual fans. What's the solution? I propose move pitching rubber back 3 inches, increase bat barrel width by millimeter, expand outfield dimensions.
Personally, I totally think, like, I don't feel strongly enough about it to, you know, look down on other people who think that baseball needs a change. But I don't want to say I'm a baseball purist either, but I don't think that baseball needs to change in order to, you know, attract more casual fans and things like that. I think that kind of falls more on the communications and marketing side of things that I think could be improved upon. I personally can't get behind any changes because I just don't think they're necessary.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that, like, really, if you know, communications and marketing departments in baseball just show how fun these players can be, especially with, hey, Mike Trout has a personality. Like, let's show the fact that he's using Space Jam in the dugout. that would make it much more fun for casual fans too.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really think that it has anything to do with the game itself, because I think one of the great things about the game, and whether it be at like the major league or minor league level, is that so many people of, you know, all different backgrounds can go to a game, and while it's slow, it's also a chance to like hang out with a friend you might not see that often. And I think that, you know, with more time in the game, you get a chance to hang out with someone who, you know, who you care about, and like get some hot dogs, get some sodas, or you know, alcoholic beverage of your choice, if that is something that you do, then, you know, that's the great part of the game. And that's why the length is, like, I don't see a problem with the length personally, because even as a casual fan, there's something for everyone in the game.
Yeah, Sarah, go ahead.
No, you go, Mina.
No, Sarah, we're just going to sit here going back and forth, and I'm going to win, so you might as well. You might as well just give in now.
Okay, fine. What I was going to say is that I am with you two on this, that I don't think that there are any substantial changes that can or should be made necessarily. However, in the spirit of the question, if we were to make a change that would significantly impact the offense, have the pitcher throw from flat ground and see what happens. Let chaos reign.
That's a good one. The other one I can think of in the spirit of the question is also juice the balls even more.
Ooh.
Make it a home run derby every game, even more so than it actually is right now.
As someone who is, like, I've grown to love home runs more than I did in my earlier days of baseball fandom, but I'm so into, you know, spectacular defense and crazy pitching and stuff like that. I would actually wonder what we would do to make it go the other way of, you know, dominant pitching. And I get that that's almost the opposite of in the spirit of the question, because it would, you know, increase strikeouts and things like that. But, I mean, and it would be, I guess, harder for the casual fan to enjoy if you weren't going to pay attention to the pitch-by-pitch minutiae, but that would be something that I would personally enjoy that I'm sure is not in the majority of opinion.
Personally, I love defense more than anything, so I would be with you on that. But... yeah, I'd be interested in seeing how they could improve defense a lot more. Maybe make sure that the dirt's not terrible, or I think the logistics of it is what I'm trying to figure out. It's like dirt, increase throwing ability, make sure that players can dive pretty well and not get injured.
You could maybe shortening, like making the infield or outfield smaller.
Yeah, I know that's a good one.
I think that might be, I mean, basically turn it into softball is my suggestion, I think, is what it's coming down to.
Make baseball softball. This is our plan. Every pitcher throws underhand
my
now.
My final opinion. Thank you.
So our next question comes from Brian at Brian_Igelko. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. If not, you have permission to yell at me. Why is it called spring training when it mostly takes place in the winter?
Because everyone's dumb. And also spring is way better than winter. So if I have to call it spring training to feel better about the impending warmer weather, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, I think that's basically what it comes down to. I think people think of baseball as being like a summer and fall game for the most part, even though it starts in the spring. And they think of the off season as being the winter, even though it starts in the fall. And I think for them, spring and calling the beginning of, you know, the getting back into it, spring training, I think that makes it seem like a cleaner break because they like the idea of it being divided clearly like that, even though that's not actually how it lines up on the calendar necessarily. I think that's why we think of the beginning of all of that as spring, even though it's in February. Yeah, it's, you know, seasons are sort of arbitrary in their way, so it's like, why not be sort of arbitrary with this as well?
Yeah, and I'm also thinking, like, a lot of seasons are, like, just on the calendar, and the places where there are spring training, Florida and Arizona, they only have, like, two seasons down there, and it's either hot or not as hot. So while it is winter elsewhere in, I know I can speak for Arizona, that in February, February in Arizona, it's like 70 degrees and sunny, and like the stormy seasons have passed already, and it's, yeah. And then Florida, it's like right before it gets super humid and hot, and it's a nice time in those states. So I think it's also seasons are different regionally, and sometimes there are places that only have two seasons. So.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So last question is from Wookiee of the Year. Great name. At WookieOTY. Aaron and Sean ask you to a board game night. What board game do you bring, and what dish and cocktail?
I think, okay, so I'm not a huge wine person, but I think I'm morally obligated to bring Dusty Baker's wine to the Dolan Doolittle household. Just to reminisce on what once was. I'm not a huge board game person because I tend to get hyper competitive is I think a nice way to put it. I don't outwardly get like competitive, but I just kind of stew in my own unhealthy competitiveness. So I would be totally cool with whatever board game Aaron and Sean provided or suggested.
If I were the one going to this board game night, that sounds amazing, and I really wish that it was a thing that I could go to. I would bring Ticket to Ride, which I don't know if you guys have played that, but it's so much fun. You can have up to, I think you can technically have up to 6 people, but also you can have a team. So you could have up to like 12 people. So it's, you know, that way. Yeah, exactly. You can like have all of the Nationals, like not all of them, like a lot of them and you. So that's a good, it's good for that reason. And also it's just really fun. And you know, if you're competitive, you're going to get like really, really into it. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. Even if people, you know, friendships end up being broken over it, you know, that's just how it goes.
Sometimes. You know,
yes. And as for a dish, I would bring multiple varieties of vanilla ice cream because, as Aaron told us on this podcast, that's what Sean's into. He likes combining vanilla frozen yogurts, and I assume that transfers over to ice cream as well. You know, I'm just trying to get on his good side here. So, yeah, he's going to eat a lot of vanilla ice cream, a lot of different kinds.
Good choice.
I like that vanilla ice cream answer. If I, you know, were to get invited to a board game night with Aaron and Sean, I would bring a vegan dish, because I know Aaron is vegan. So I'm really trying to get on Aaron's side more than anything. And the board game I would bring would be the Bob Ross game sold at Target called The Art of Chill.
Oh my god.
Because I feel like it's very online, but not, like, too online, but online in a way that Aaron and Sean could appreciate.
Yeah, I changed my answer forever and always to the Bob Ross chill game.
Okay, wait, I actually have a challenger. I totally just remember that this was a thing. Have you two ever heard of the Vanilla Ice rap game?
No.
This was a thing that existed in the 90s, and I think very few copies of it exist in this day and age, because I've looked for it. I've tried to find it. I can't find it. They play it on this, like, board game show that I watch sometimes, and it's amazing. Basically, you have to, like, make your own raps, like, and they have this microphone that, like, provides the beats for you. But it's, like, one beat, because, you know, it was the 90s, and nobody could do technology for real, I guess. But yeah, you like end up having to do these like terrible raps with this like one beat over and over again, and it's incredible. So I would somehow find a copy of that and I would bring that, because I think it would be an unforgettable evening.
That is my new favorite thing. If I can't find an actual copy in real life, because it doesn't appear that any copies exist for sale, I want them to produce replicas of it, because I want that in my life. And I want to play it with Aaron and Sean.
So this was whole, like, all just a long con to get Aaron and Sean to invite all of us over for a board game night, is basically what this question was. So Aaron, Sean, we are going to send the link to this podcast to you until you click on it and listen and invite us over.
Yeah, we've already planned everything. I mean, there's nothing they have to do. They just have to open their home to us.
I mean, it's vanilla ice wrap game and vanilla ice cream.
It's perfect. It's a theme. We have a theme in everything.
So, Aaron and John, if you're listening to this, well, you know how to contact us. Clearly. If only that could happen. Well, who knows? It could happen. And that concludes this episode of the Horrible Times Audio. Thanks for tuning in. You can find the site at fangraphs.com/THD and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find our guest host, Mina, at MADDC8. And you can find our absent host who decided to abandon us this weekend, Mary, at Mary M. Craig. No, I am not completely bitter. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode, and Mary might be back.